Hello, in this audio snippet, we will continue talking about race and with the intention of eventually having a better understanding of what races are and what racism is. And these concepts need to be understood and somehow introduced into the new American Constitution. In other words, we cannot have a well-functioning constitution without an understanding of race, what racism really is, and having those ideas plastered in a tangible way or a literal way within the new American Constitution. We have been talking about race over and over and over again, and it's interesting that neither side has expressed any interest in really plastering these thoughts into the Constitution. The conservatives don't want to or don't care about changing the Constitution to have concepts related to race mentioned there, because to them the Constitution is basically perfect, so there's nothing really to change there from their point of view. And from the liberals' point of view, the Constitution is an obstacle to getting more tyranny implemented. So they couldn't care less about that document. They just want to implement their tyranny and be done with it. So that's why we're discussing race and race and concepts of race and racism in these audio snippets. We have to understand them in order to create a more perfect form of government and a perfect constitution. And we're going to mention some concepts very quickly that we had already mentioned before. We'll just repeat them in a different way to hopefully emphasize some points and add a little bit of extra context. We were saying in previous audio snippets about the concept of color blindness, and we shared that there's a curious tendency from the liberal ideological goddesses that are out there that they have pushed this new liberal tendency to disdain the concept of color blindness. In other words, they don't want people to think in color blind terms, and they become very. I have seen it firsthand, the angry reaction that they have when a conservative says that we should be color blind, and there's a whole lot of ideology that's been built around rejecting that. And you would think, well, that's kind of a strange thing. Why would a liberal who's supposedly for equal rights and all that rubbish, and I say rubbish because there's nothing wrong with equal rights. The problem is what they understand by equal rights. So they would seem to be the people who you would expect to be for color blindness more than anybody else. But the reason why they are against color blindness is because it's basically threefold. One reason is that their ideology goddess teaches them that conservatives are racists and can therefore never be color blind, even if they say they are, or even if they act like they are, or even if they do all the things that a color blind person would do. Liberals are ideologues. They are religious fanatics, and their religion is their ideology, their liberal ideology. And unfortunately, when you have religious nuts like that, liberals everything is measured from what their ideology teaches. In other words, things are not judged on their own merit. They're not judged independently on what they are per se. They are judged based on what their ideology goddess tells them about those things. So whenever they want to judge something, they take it with their hands And usually what you do when you judge something is you grab it, I mean, literally or figuratively, and you bring it close to your eyes and you examine it, and then you go, okay, this is good, this is bad, and that's how you normally judge things. But what religious fanatics like these liberal ideologues do is they grab it, instead of analyzing it themselves, they bring it to their ideology goddess and then they say, hey, oh great ideology goddess of liberalism, what do you say about this thing? And then the ideology goddess says, oh, this is good, this is bad. And then they come back and start telling everybody this is good or this is bad, depending on what the ideology goddess said. And this ideology goddess is almost like a spirit force, in a sense, that is moved and takes shape through the intellectuals in all these universities that kind of come together and start writing out all this nonsense. And then it just gets propagandized through the education, quote-unquote, system that we have, and that's how all the religious fanatics of liberalism get indoctrinated with the teachings. So there's this ideological goddess that is out there decreeing what is true and what isn't, and that's why suddenly things that were normal become abnormal, or things that used to be considered abnormal suddenly become normal. And we mentioned, if I'm not mistaken, previously about the Washington Redskins, the American football team that played in Washington, D.C. They had been called the Redskins for decades and decades. I remember when I was a kid, I grew up in Baltimore, which is right near Washington, D.C., and everybody called them the Redskins. No one had any problem with that. I don't remember ever hearing of an Amerindian ever complaining about the Redskins. Everyone was fine with it. Democrats, Republicans, people of every color and creed called them the Redskins. And no one had a problem with that. And then suddenly someone decided, hey, that's not, Redskin is a racist name. And then all of a sudden, everybody in the liberal congregation started saying, that's a bad name and we have to change it, we have to change it. And eventually they changed it. A team that was, in a sense, promoting the Amerindian culture or reminding people of the presence of the Amerindian in America. Now that team is, I forget, I think they changed their name to something else because they were nameless for a year or so, which was ridiculous. That's how pathetic it was. The name is so disgusting that we're not going to have a name, but we don't know what else to call ourselves. So for a year or so, we shall remain nameless. And they just were supposed to be called the Washington football team, which is ridiculous, totally ridiculous. And I think I forget what other stupid name they eventually chose. And everything that was related to the Amerindian was erased from the name. So instead of honoring Amerindians, now the football team has nothing to do with Amerindians in any way. We were saying before, what team names itself after something that is dishonorable? You know, who wants to call themselves the, let's say, the Washington Cockroaches or the Washington Vomit or, you know, the Washington Sewer? No one names their team or their organization after something, you know, or the Washington Fecal Matter. You know, no one does that. If you, for example, when Minnesota football team is called the Vikings. why isn't that racist? You know, it's okay, you know, that's a race. But the reason why it's not racist is because they're people to understand, the Vikings is a reference to these, you know, mighty warriors who are plunderers and all that sort of thing. And the team is adopting that and taking it with pride and saying, hey, we are like these ancient warriors. And so when you take on a name, you're basically ascribing something good to it and saying, I am partaking of that good quality, and I'm naming my team after this thing, and we want our team to have the good quality that we see in this that we are naming ourselves after. So there was nothing dishonorable about the name Redskin, and the fact that it mentions the color red and skin is not racist in any way. What is wrong with having a reddish skin? You know, brown is a combination of red and I think it's green. I forget the other color that combines to form brown. So there's nothing wrong with the name per se. The point is, it was okay for so many years, and suddenly it became evil, and then everybody was against it. When 20 or 30 years earlier, the very same people had absolutely no problem saying the name out loud. So that's how liberals operate. So one of the things that the ideology goddess that they worship has taught them is every single conservative is a racist. So if a conservative comes and claims or promotes color blindness, they're just hypocrites because they are racists. No matter what they do, no matter what they say, they're racist, they're not colorblind, they are lying to themselves, they're lying to us, they're lying to all of us because they're all racists. Why are they all racists? Because the ideology goddess says they are. And it doesn't matter how they act, how they behave, they will always be racists because they are not analyzing people's racism based on the actions that they perform. They're just judging them based on what the ideology goddess tells them about those people. So that's one reason why they reject it when conservatives talk about color blindness or a color blind society. That's one reason. The second reason is that they need to keep the races balkanized in our society and at war with the evil white man. And the reason is that allows them to continue using race as a demagogic tool of emotional control over people. Every dictator, and the liberals are dictators and tyrants, every dictatorship usually needs an enemy to rally the people around in an emotional way that gets around common sense and truth. You saw it in Germany, for example, during the Hitler years, that they created the Jew as the enemy that needed to be attacked and killed. In communism, in Cuba, for example, it was the imperialist white gringo who was oppressing the people, and they created this monster, and they rallied the people around this evil capitalist imperialist monster to attack it. So they can't have a colorblind society because that gives them one less tool to manipulate people and to control them emotionally, and to kind of galvanize them against this imaginary enemy that they need to fight all the time. So they need to keep the race thing going. So they can't afford to have a colorblind society or a society that goes towards color blindness. And the third reason why they don't want color blindness is that that they need people to continue seeing race as a way to judge a priori to judge people without having to really judge them or think or analyze them. And that sounds strange because you would think that they would not want people to go around judging others based on race. But that's exactly what they want. And what they want is that they want people to see it this way. If it's done by a white person, it's more than likely wrong. So you have to you automatically start from a position of this person's wrong, and this whitey will have to prove him or herself right. And if it's done by a non-white person, then more than likely it's a good thing, and if it looks like a bad thing, it's more than likely something that this white non-white person did after being provoked by a white person. So in other words, if it's done by whitey, more than likely it's wrong, and if it's done by a non-whitey, more than likely it's good, and if it's not, technically good, it must have been something that the whitey provoked him or her to do. And that's the way they judge everything. That's why if black people go around looting, you know, as when what happened a couple of years ago when that BLM stuff was going on here in New York, there was severe looting and in many cities, and when that was happening, because it was being done mostly by black people, all the liberals said that's okay, you know. And they're just reacting, being provoked somehow by 400 years of white oppression. But if white people were doing something similar, looting businesses owned by black people or something like that, there'd be complete outrage. So every time a black person does it, it's okay, it's understandable, they're just being oppressed and so forth. But if a white person does something 25% as bad as what a black person is doing, then it's evil. And it's just, the white man is Satan in the flesh, that sort of thing. Like, for example, here in the New York area, I don't know if it's still going on, I think it might still be happening, that a lot of Oriental people, especially elderly Oriental people, were being punched and attacked for no reason at all by black people on the street, just randomly, just for the sake of it. And because these attackers, and they were always, videotaped, because there's a lot of video cameras all around New York, you know, it's kind of a little bit like London, even though London has a lot more camera CCTV coverage, you could say, than New York, but New York still has a lot of cameras to show stuff going on the street. And so these attacks are recorded, it's not rumors of attacks. And because when they show the attacks, it's always a black person. When they do show it on the news, it's always in a very reserved tone. And, you know, they mention the attack, and if you have any information, so and so. But they don't make a big deal out of it because it's a black person. But if it were white people going around punching Oriental people, you can imagine how all hell would break loose, and then there'd be riots again and all sorts of things. Because if a white man does it, it's the end of the world. But if a black man does it, it's okay. You know, it's understandable. So they need to continue that sort of judgment going on. And you can't judge the world in that warped sort of way if you're colorblind. Because you need, to them, it's necessary to see the color in order to judge it. If it's done by whitey, it's bad. If it's done by non-whitey, it's understandable. It's good or it's understandable. So that's why they don't like color blindness. And then on the other side, you have conservatives who embrace color blindness, and you say that think that's a good thing, but it really isn't a good thing, and it's And you can say that because of the three reasons that conservatives embrace colorblindness. One reason is they want to avoid having to think in terms that are different from the scope of their ideology. So just like liberals are religious fanatics who worship this liberal goddess, this liberal ideology, religion that they follow faithfully and tyrannically, conservatives have their own ideology. It's a milder form of religious fanaticism, but it's still an ideology and a religion, and that religion revolves around the founding fathers, the Constitution, and worshiping the flag and the country and Betsy Ross and Yankee Doodle Dandy and all these things. And there's nothing wrong with honoring the flag. I personally always, when I'm walking on the street and I see an American flag, I usually tip my hat to it. And I do that literally because I'm almost always wearing a hat. And I see nothing wrong with respecting the American flag, or when you see a memorial to war veterans or people who died in wars. My heart always gets burdened because I realize that these family members, the family members of the people who died in war, never got a chance to see their loved ones come back home. You know, fathers and brothers and sons that never came back. And that's just so permanent. And so sad not only for them who lost their lives, but who sacrificed their lives fighting for the country, but also the families who had to kind of live with that void, that emptiness, that absence for the rest of their lives. So there's nothing wrong with appreciating all of that, but conservatives kind of take it to a level where they end up dishonoring the things that they supposedly honor. As we've said before, the Constitution, current American Constitution, is a crappy document. It's really terrible. The more you analyze it, the more disappointing it becomes. But when you start worshiping it the way conservatives do, it goes from crappy to being crap. Not that the document is crap. It's crappy, but it's not crap. And I know that sounds strange, but there is a difference between the two. But when you worship it that way, then you turn it into crap. Then it becomes this idol that you're worshiping, this object of idolatry, and then it becomes disgusting and deplorable. And that's why in these audio snippets, we sometimes sound so harsh against it. Because when we see people worshiping it like that, it becomes disdainful and disgusting, and it must be spoken of as a disgusting thing that you must get away from. But conservatives, you know, they embrace all of these things, and they live in this limited world, and they don't want to think about things that go outside that scope. It's as if the founding fathers created the perfect form of government. It's as if the New Jerusalem descended from heaven the day that the founding fathers ratified or finished drafting the Constitution, and it got ratified. That's the day that the perfect form of government appeared on the face of the earth. And anything that goes uncomfortably outside the scope, that limited form of perfection, is unpleasant to them. They don't. So racism doesn't fit into that, especially because the founding fathers didn't really address the issue of racism, of race and racism, very well, as we all know, with slavery. So they don't want to go there. So they just want, okay, let's have a colorblind society. Let's forget about the whole thing, and move on. And that goes into the second reason why they want to embrace colorblindness. It allows them to avoid having to face issues of the past. Issues like what the white Southerners did to black people, even 100 years after the Civil War. You know, in the 1960s, we still had segregation and severe racism going on in the Deep South in the 1960s, which is 100 years after the Civil War, which happened during the 1860s. And so there was no more slavery, but still it's as if the South said, we are going to continue this way. No one is going to tell us what to do and not to do. And so we had all these things, and then these things kept festering and festering, and we're still living out the consequences of them. And the conservative doesn't want to face the past, because if they face the past and face the issues of racism in the past, it just makes them uncomfortably aware of how faulty the founding fathers and their form of government was or is. So they just don't want to go there. And that's why they can have this idea that, well, yeah, we're in a colorblind society, but at the same time, we have monuments to Robert E. Lee, to Jefferson Davis. And to those of you who might not know, Jefferson Davis was the one and only president of the Confederate States of America when the South seceded from the North during the Civil War to try to, you know, become this independent nation where they could have slavery without any limitations. They chose a president, and the president was Jefferson Davis, and their leading commander of the Army of the South was Robert E. Lee. And we still have in the South statues to these men and other Confederate people. And the conservative thinks that's okay. And they can have a colorblind society and still honor this. And they say, oh, that's history. That's our history. Well, yeah, Hitler was also, as we've said before, Hitler was also part of Germany's history. But you don't see people in Germany with statues of Hitler in, you know, in the middle of their parks or their public spaces. It's part of their history, but it's a part of their history that they would rather forget and that they are ashamed about. And they are openly ashamed about it. But in the South, it was like, okay, you know, and the Confederate flag, even as a kid, it bothered me to, the Confederate flag always bothered me because to me, it was like, okay, this is the flag of a country that was formed to protect and defend the right to own slaves. And how can you possibly see it as a source of pride? It'd be a source of shame, especially those Southerners who claim to be Christian and who have an awareness of God. Do they think that their God was okay with them doing what they did and seceding from the North and fighting just because they had to hold on to slavery at all costs? Do they think that their God was okay with that? Don't they realize that if their God exists, that God would not be too happy with seeing that flag as a reminder of their rebellion against His will? So there is no consistency there. And it all goes to this idea, out of sight, out of mind. I don't want to think about it. It's in the past, but I don't want to see it. And it gets to the blindness of saying, okay, I'm willing to honor Robert E. Lee and Jefferson Davis and still claim that I am colorblind. And yes, they are trying to be colorblind, but at the same time, ignoring what was done in the past and the consequences of that. And so, someone has to address it. Even if conservatives are not racist, and the vast majority of conservatives are not racists at all, they are much more egalitarian than liberals will ever be. And you can see it, for example, in the cities run by Democrats, by liberals. Black people are poor. Black people's schools are in disarray, and they suffer a great deal when those cities are run by conservatives or those places are run by conservatives. The lives of the black people there are much better. So conservatives are much more egalitarian, but that does not mean that they should just pretend like the past never happened, and because the consequences of the past live on to this day, and we have to deal with it, address it, and confront it. We can't just pretend like there are no colors and live in this colorblind world, because the world as it is not colorblind, and never will be. There are shades. It's not just white and black. It's a shade, a variety of colors, and we have to recognize it. We have to live with the consequences of the past and deal with it. That's not a valid situation. That goes into the third factor, that color blindness allows conservatives to avoid having to face issues happening today, where race is clearly a factor. So those are the three reasons why conservatives want to be colorblind. They want to avoid having to think in terms that are different from the scope of their ideology. The founding fathers, they have the perfect government, so we don't have to think about anything outside of that limited scope. And number two, color blindness allows them to avoid having to face issues of the past. And third, it allows them to avoid having to face issues happening today, where race is clearly a factor. You have to consider race. You can't, avoid understanding or thinking about race or speaking about it openly. So color blindness is like a good and a bad idea. It's a bad idea in the sense that it prevents us understanding the underlying factors affecting many events around us. In other words, if we are colorblind or race blind, would be the better term, then we are kind of eliminating an obvious factor that's influencing behavior, and then we have a harder time addressing or understanding what's going on. It's almost like, for example, Daltonism. People who are colorblind in real life, they have trouble with certain colors. The traffic lights are more difficult to discern because they are missing a shade or something in their vision that doesn't allow them to see the world exactly as it is. And that's what you become when you are colorblind. In the sense that conservatives want, mean it. But in another sense, it's a good idea, but in terms of judging individual matters. So even though race may help to understand the factors at play when an action is happening, once we know what the factors are that influenced an action, then color becomes irrelevant. So you could say that, for example, if let's say someone took a gun, put it next to someone's temple, pulled the trigger, and blew the guy's brains out. Maybe it was a white man, and this black man came and killed him because he was white. And then maybe there was some racial factors there, some resentment and all that. And you analyze the situation and you see, okay, there was this racial resentment that happened, and that's why this black man killed this white man and all that. So you factor all that in. But once you factor it all in, then you judge the action based on the action itself. Okay, it doesn't matter whether it was race motivated or not race motivated, blowing somebody's brains out like that. It doesn't sound like a good thing, and it's wrong. But understanding the factors gives you a perspective and elements to consider. But at the end of the day, what you judge is the action itself, and you say this is very wrong. And it doesn't matter the color of the person pulling the trigger; the action still has these. Strong consequences, and you will judge it according to those consequences. And you may analyze some factors along the way, but at the end of the day, the action is judged in a colorblind way. But so That's why color blindness can be good and bad at the same time. So now that we have cleared this up, I hope, even though there are concepts we have been saying already, I think it was worth repeating in a different way. So now that we've said that, we can move on quickly to some things about the racial groups in Europe, and then we'll move on. As we've said before, humanity can be divided into 12 tribes or racial groups. Five of them are in Asia, five of them are from Europe, you could say, and one is in Africa, and one is in the Americas. And the five tribes in Europe, you could say, are the Nordics, the Germanics, the Celts, the Latins, and the Slavs. And we mentioned that these five tribes correspond to the five aspects of the human personality. There are actually seven aspects to the human personality, but five are more or less innate. In other words, you're born with them. And the other two are what I call the wild card elements. And those wild card elements are more by choice. It's like you choose to enter into them and embrace them in one way or another. They're not factory settings, you could say. But these five are, and the five elements of the human personality that you kind of are born with, in a sense, and develop with time are the judge personality, the visionary personality, the conqueror personality, the server personality or waiter personality, and the teacher or organizer personality. Those are the five elements that people are born with. The judge is, as we said before, is a person who's always saying this is right, this is wrong, this is good, this is bad. The judgy people, and they tend to be the people who operate more in innovation, because they are they have this ability to judge what's right and wrong. They start to discern laws and patterns of behavior or action. So they when they enter into the sciences, they discover new laws, new principles. And because of that, they innovate and create new wisdom, new ideas. But then if they take their judging in a bad way, they become very legalistic, very harsh and very cruel people. And then you have the visionary, the person who was always living for a cause, who has this vision of something in the future, and they're willing to sacrifice their lives for that vision, that cause. And they can be people who move society forward and point people towards a new vision. And at the same time, if they get carried away with that, they in a bad sense, or fall prey or get deceived into following a bad cause, then they start living their lives pursuing this evil cause and doing harm to society as a result. And terrorists are people who have this visionary component that has been kind of led astray. So they are willing to lay down their lives and do all this horrible destruction for the sake of a false cause. So it has its good aspect and its bad aspect. Every element of the human personality has its good side and its bad side, depending on how you use it. Then you have the conqueror personality. These are the people who are always out to achieve and expand and obtain more. Salespeople are conquerors. They like to go out and conquer sales, and they are the most charming people, in the sense of they get you to follow them and to trust them and to believe in them. And So if, when you know, when you are dealing with someone that you go, okay, I will follow that person to the ends of the earth, then you're dealing with a conqueror, because that person has conquered your heart, your will. It's like, that's what they do. They conquer people's hearts, and they go out and achieve and expand. But when it's used in a bad way, they become users of people. They conquer just to use and satisfy what they want from that person or thing, and then they throw it away and move on. So it has a good side and a bad side. And then you have the servers, the people who like to please others, who like to serve them. Unfortunately, when that gets distorted, the server becomes sort of a manipulator in an underhanded way, where they use their service to get your loyalty, so that they serve you, but with the intent of kind of controlling you through that service, so that you become so appreciative of their service that you want to please them back. And when you want to please them back, then you become a subject to them. So the server can act in that way. It can be, and they are probably the most dangerous of all the personalities when they get distorted, because it's a very subtle form of control. And then you have the organizers. The organizers are people who like to put things into categories. They like to group things, and they are very perfectionists. They like efficiency, and they usually go into the teaching profession. A lot of them have this teacher mentality. Because a teacher needs to be able to organize things. A teacher takes knowledge and organizes it in such a way that, and breaks it down in such a way that it's easy to learn and teach. And organizers also are very prone to making procedures and steps. They're the ones who write manuals and say, okay, step number one, step number two, step number three to execute a task. And they also are very bureaucratic. They like forms. So all the forms you see out there, they're written by organizers. And sometimes they go overboard. When that attribute goes bad, they become promoters of endless bureaucracy, where the procedure is more important than what the procedure was written for, and so forth. So these are the five personalities that people are born with, and they are kind of a lot of people have combinations of these personalities, and I believe that the idea of a human being is to grow into all five aspects. In other words, the perfect human is one who is a good judge, a good visionary, a good conqueror, a good server, and a good organizer. And it's like everybody is born with those qualities, and if they develop them properly, they can impart that quality to other people. And it's like we are in this world to kind of complete our spectrum of our personality. And you learn to be a better judge when you're around people who are judging correctly. Or you get like an impartation of the visionary personality when you're around visionaries, and you become a conqueror when you're around conquerors, and it's not like, okay, he's a conqueror and I wasn't born a conqueror and I'm okay with I'll do my thing, he'll do his. We all do our thing, but as we're doing our thing, we are to grow into other things, including things that we were not born with. So that's what these personalities are all about. And it seems like the five tribes in Europe correlate with these personalities. And the Nordics are the judging type. as we've explained before, the Germanics are the organizers. That's why Germans are so efficient. And they also have a lot of judging personality. As we are saying these things, we're not saying that each tribe is just exclusively judge or exclusively organizer. We're saying in the context of their role in Europe, they have predominantly this quality in them, even though they have other personalities or elements in them. So the Germanics are also, because they are very closely related to the Nordics, they have a lot of judging personality as well. And they also have like a subtle layer of conqueror personality. And then the Celts are the visionaries of Europe. And that's why, as we've said before, you know, Celtic music is so mystical, so spiritual, because they have this visionary quality about them. And that also visionary people can also have this tendency to fall into depression or states of sorrow and sadness, because they're living by a vision. So they dream of a vision, and they just like they get hopeful about a vision, they also enter into great despair when the vision is not fulfilled. And that's why Celtic people, like the Irish, are known for their bouts of depression, and that's why a lot of them fall into alcoholism, because they're trying to drown out that sorrow, depression that they have, because they're not living out their visionary calling, and there's an emptiness in them, and they try to fill it with something else, and that's why it's important to understand races and say, okay, this race has a certain quality to it. The people within this race are born with these attributes, more or less. It's not that every Celt is, you know, is exactly like this, but you see patterns of behavior, and then you understand why they behave a certain way. And then you have the Latins, as we said before, they are the servers of Europe, and that's why, interestingly, they are the ones most directly connected with food. You know, the Spaniards, the Italians, the Greeks, and the Portuguese, you know, food, because they are servers. They like to serve and please people, and they're very passionate because of that. The server personality is the one is probably the most passionate one. They are they seem to be more they have an empathy, because the server wants to please, so that he needs to feel what the other person feels, and that creates this kind of emotional connection between people, and that's why the Latins are probably the most emotional in terms of human connection of all the Europeans. The others, like the Nordics and the Germanics, are a little bit colder, you could say. The Celts are tribal in a way, but they're not as emotional as the Latins. But the Latins have that because of their server personality. And then you have the Slavs, who are the conquerors of Europe. And that's why, even in a geographical sense, the Slavic people, you know, most people don't realize this, but if you think in terms of area of control, the Slavs control the amount of territory that is run or controlled by Slavic people is much, much greater than all the other racial or tribal groups combined. Russia is Slavic, and you know how Russia is. Russia is the largest country in the world because they are conquerors, expansive. And you have all these countries in Eastern Europe that are populated by Slavic people. As opposed to the other tribes that have a limited number of countries where they have, you could say, the control. So they are the conquerors. They have this conqueror quality about them, but also because of their conqueror quality, they also become very opportunistic, and sometimes that has led to them taking advantage of each other in a bad way. And that has led to a lot of the corruption that Russia has experienced over the years, and some of the countries in Eastern Europe as well. But it's important to understand that element in them and to see, oh, that's why they behave like this. So that's why you can't be colorblind, and more than colorblind, you can't be race blind, because it prevents you understanding why people behave a certain way. It doesn't mean that every Nordic behaves the same way, again, but you can see the patterns of behavior based on race. And just as a side note, it's worth mentioning, if you go through Europe, just to get an idea of where the racial groups are, because they are kind of intermingled. It's not that they're all kind of bunched into these separate five regions of Europe, where you can clearly see the Nordics are here, the Germanics are here, and so forth. But if you start with the Nordics obviously are predominant in Scandinavia, Sweden, Norway, and Denmark, in the continent, and Finland has a lot of Nordic influence, but they're also mixed in a little bit with the Slavic people. So the Finland is, you could say, half Nordic, half Slavic, and a little bit Germanic. They're not as Nordic, as pure Nordic as the other countries in Scandinavia, Sweden and Norway, and Denmark. Down below, they are strongly Nordic. And then you have the Germanics. Obviously, Germany is Germanic, but there's a lot of Germanic influence to the east of Germany, and a little bit to the west. Germany has a strong influence in Hungary and Czechoslovakia, or the Czech Republic and Slovakia, especially in the Czech Republic. A lot of Germanic people there, mixed with Slavic people. In Hungary as well. Czechoslovakia, I'm sorry for saying it like that. I know the country doesn't exist anymore, but it's easier to say Czech Republic and Slovakia. So Czechoslovakia and Hungary are very Germanic, combined with Slavic. And Poland has a lot of Germanic influence as well, but they are more Slavic, and a little bit of Nordic combined there as well. So Eastern Europe is mostly Slavic. The other Eastern European countries are mostly Slavic. Bulgaria is very Slavic. And Romania is more of a combination of Slavic and Latin. And that's why the Romanian language is very, very Latinized. They have a lot of Latin influence from the Greeks and the Italians, you could say, genetically, combined with the Slavic people. And then if you start moving down a little bit towards Italy, Italy is obviously Latin. If you go back up north, Switzerland is very Germanic. That's why half of Switzerland, or I forget the percentage, but maybe 60% of Switzerland is Germanic or speaks German as a primary language, and the other half speaks French. And Luxembourg is Germanic, and so forth. Belgium is very Germanic. The Dutch, the Netherlands and Belgium are very Germanic people, and obviously the Netherlands, the Dutch language is almost, it's very similar to the German language, so clearly the German connection is there, very evident. And then when you go into France, France is a very, very peculiar mixture of different influences. France is very Germanic because of the Frankish peoples, who were Germanics, who went into France. And you also have the Gauls, who were the Celts. So they have a strong Celtic influence as well. And then you have the Latin influence from Spain and Italy. So they have this very peculiar mixture of these three groups, the Latins, the French, the Germanics, and the Celts. So France is a very peculiar nation in that sense. And then Spain, right next door, is very obviously Latin, very strong Latin, along with Portugal. And then if you go back up to the British Isles, Britain is also another, just like France, a very peculiar combination. Obviously, they have the Anglo-Saxon influence, which Saxony is in Germany, so it's an influence of people from Germany. They have the Norman influence from the Norman invasion, and the Normans were a mixture of Celtic with Nordic. So there's a very strong Nordic influence in Britain, and obviously they have the Celtic influence in Ireland, Wales, and Scotland. All that has they're Celtic people. So you have the Celtic influence with the Germanic influence, along with the Nordic influence. That's what mostly comprises the UK. And that's more or less just to give you a very wide panorama of how those five racial groups are interacting in Europe. So now that we have mentioned that, let's move on quickly to other things we wanted to say about race. So we have kind of established that racial groups come with certain factory settings. People who are born into a certain race tend to have these or have a higher likelihood of exhibiting certain elements of the human personality than other races. Just like there are physical differences, there are also behavioral differences. So that's why people of a certain race are kind of like more predisposed to behave a certain way than people of other races. Or, some races have people who are physically taller than other people. So it's physical and behavioral. And it comes like from factory. That leads to people of the same race tending to behave in similar ways. At the end of the day, everyone is individual. Everyone's actions are individual, so they can't. You cannot judge a person just by the race. Everyone is the master of their own destiny and decides how they will or will not behave. But you can see patterns of behavior. And that influences because of genetic components, like things that are born from factory. So that's one factor that influences behavior. And the other is just the mere fact that people of the same race tend to hang out together. They hang around each other because they're physically similar, naturally. They're of the same race, so they have the same family, so they grew up in a family of people who are of the same race, and then these families are together in a nation or a society or a city or a neighborhood. So people of the same race tend to hang around people of the same race. And because of that, they not only come with similar factory settings, but also they start emulating the behavior of the people around them. So it's like a culture, just like in biology or whatever, that they talk about these cultures, this petri dish where they have certain bacteria developing into like a culture of bacteria. In the same way with races, people of the same race are like in a petri dish and they're developing a certain pattern of behavior because they're emulating each other. They're watching each other and kind of absorbing each other's attitudes. And that's how they start behaving in similar ways. And it's And the thing is that, and then there's also the human will factor. So it doesn't mean that, how can I say it, that everybody of similar personalities living together will always end up behaving the exact same way, because it depends on historical factors. Because it's almost as if people start emulating each other, but there's a point where people decide, okay, we're going to do this a certain way and go in this direction. And they all become influenced by someone or something, and they start going in a certain direction, but it's like by an act of human will. So you take those same people or the same circumstances, and you go back 200 years, and under the same circumstances, some people would behave a different way because the people of that generation had different ideas. So even though the factors were similar, they started behaving in a slightly different way. So you have the genetic factor, that's number one, that influences what personalities you're born with. Then you have the second factor, which is hanging around each other and emulating each other's attitudes. And then number three, the human will factor. And that means that the tendencies of behavior can go in different ways, depending on the human will of the people living in that time or that place. So those are the three things that combine to form cultural behavior. And the thing is that, and this is kind of what we're trying to get to in these audio snippets, is that in time, certain people start developing certain habits. And sometimes they're good habits, and sometimes they're bad habits. And if a certain culture adopts a certain value system, because of their personality, of them hanging out together, and them kind of collectively choosing to go, okay, we're going to go in this direction, and they tend to decide to go in that direction, then at some point, some cultures develop some attitudes that are superior or inferior to other cultures. It's just a fact of life. It's not just a matter of different foods, and that's what the liberals always want to portray, that cultures are just, you know, these people like to dress a certain way and eat a certain type of food and dance a certain type of music, dance to a certain type of music and so forth. It's not, it's more than that. There is moral behavior that starts playing in. And then some cultures start accumulating all these bad habits. And they might have some good habits that are better than other cultures, but then when you weigh them all together, the good and the bad habits, some cultures start showing signs of inferiority compared to other cultures. So overall, certain cultures are just inferior to other cultures. And that's why we were talking so much about the Amerindians in the other snippets, because their cultures, especially, going towards South America from Mexico on down, their cultures were clearly inferior to the European culture. It doesn't mean that that the Amerindian was inherently inferior to the European. It's not that the European is inherently superior, the white man is superior to the Amerindian, it's just that the culture was inferior. Can you imagine a culture where 1% of the population is being killed off in human sacrifices every year? That's what the Aztecs in Mexico were doing at the time, when the Europeans arrived. Very violent, evil culture. And not only violent, evil, backward. That's why it only took a few hundred Europeans to conquer cities of hundreds of thousands of Amerindians, because they were technologically inferior. Why were the technologically inferior? Not because they were more stupid than the Europeans. They just chose to live under a culture and a value system that didn't promote growth, technological growth, educational growth of the people. While in Europe, they were doing all these things with science and philosophy, here in the Americas, the Amerindians were killing each other and oppressing each other and abusing each other. They were so backward that they couldn't even come up with the wheel, as we said before. The wheel was being used thousands of years before in Babylonia, in Babylon, and and all of Mesopotamia, and even in Europe before it became more civilized, and thousands of years ago. And here, in the Americas, they were still not aware of the wheel. That's how backward they were. And it's not only technologically, they were morally inferior. If you look in Africa, all the witchcraft and all these terrible things that they were practicing, living in superstition, and that's why they remained backward. While the white man was progressing, the cultures in sub-Saharan Africa were trapped in backwardness. And there were a few exceptions, like the Ethiopians, who, because of their influence from the Hebrew culture, they were a little bit different from the rest of the sub-Saharan black Africans, but overall, the cultures that developed there were inferior. That's why when the white men arrived, they were so able to conquer and control so much of Africa, because the African societies were primitive or backward. And even to this day, you go there and you see all the poverty, despair, and corruption. Look, Nigeria is famous for all the corruption that goes on because the culture is morally void. It has lacking factors. And you can understand why, and that goes to another audio snippet, why you see all these things in black Africa. Because the black race is very visionary, but it lacks a lot of the other elements of the personality, and when it rejects those elements from other races and it doesn't absorb them and refuses to absorb them and embrace them and operate in them, then it can go very, very astray and go into this aimless decay. So what we can say is, just like you can, the liberals are always praising, the wonderful thing about the Hispanic culture or the black culture and this and that. Well, yes, if there are wonderful things, there are also bad things. I mean, you can't have your cake and eat it too. If you are going to say that certain cultures exhibit these wonderful qualities, then you have to be willing to admit that they can also exhibit these bad qualities, and of oppression or moral decay, lack of scruples, etc. The thing is that also, the same people can have superior or inferior cultures over time, because it also depends on where the people decide to go. It's like they can have an awakening, a revival, an epiphany, and go, okay, we're going to operate in a certain way and move away from bad patterns of behavior towards good patterns of behavior. And also within the same people, you can have subcultures where some subcultures, some are inferior to others. It's not that the people are inferior, it's the culture they've developed is inferior. It's like, it's like having some businesses are better than others. Some businesses know how to do things, they put out good quality products, and the consumers like it, and they prosper and grow, and other companies don't do it as well. They don't produce as well, so they become inferior companies. It's not that the people in the company were of a like children of a lesser god or are inherently inferior, they just put out a worse product than the other company. And that's what's what happens with the races. So the problem, and that's when the it becomes very difficult to distinguish between the two. And that's what liberals prey on to create confusion. You can have, you can believe that one culture is inferior to another without believing that one person is inherently inferior to another. And I hope that makes sense. So in other words, it's okay, it's necessary to be a culturalist. And I heard that term used once in on a television show, and that show didn't run for too long. I even forget the name of the show, but there was a character who said something very interesting one day, and I said, "Wow, that's interesting. That's exactly what I believe." And I had never heard anyone verbalize it. That and it's a reality that he said, "I'm a culturalist." In other words, I believe some cultures are superior to others, and that's different from racism. Racism believes one race of people is inherently superior to another race, and the other race is inherently inferior and will never achieve the greatness of the other race. But the confusing thing is that cultures revolve around race, and that's why some people say, "Oh, I think the way Black people are behaving is destroying themselves. They're living in an inferior culture," and that's immediately taken to say, "Oh, so you're saying Black people are inferior?" No, the culture is inferior, and it's showing these patterns of behavior that need to be changed, and it comes from their personality traits. They're getting corrupted by certain external factors, and we need to change it. But you have to admit it's inferior. The Black culture has these wonderful qualities, the great music, the great artistic work from the visionary element of them. But then you have the other elements of it that are clearly destroying them. And you have to say that's inferior. That's an inferior culture. We have to recognize it as inferior in order to change it. But that doesn't mean that you're saying Black people are inherently inferior. And that confusion between race and culture is what causes all the problems. So you can declare one culture inferior to another without actually saying that a race is inferior to another. But the problem is because cultures revolve around race, it sounds like you are condemning the race or declaring the race inferior when you're declaring inferior is the culture. And we'll continue, and this snippet went way too long. We'll continue talking about this and other things related to race in the next audio snippet. Thank you very much for listening.